This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, August 10th, 2010. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, civilian casualties in Afghanistan are up by 30% for the first half of this year.
The levels of violence in the South today are unprecedented, that if you compare to any other time in the last 10 years, this is the most violent year.
We'll look at the details of a new UN report. U.S. Defense Secretary Gates plans to cut jobs and costs, but some say the move leaves the department's massive overall budget largely intact. And immigrant rights groups release internal government documents on the Secure Communities program. Critics say the government is misleading the public about its intent.
What our community sees is loved ones and friends being racially profiled, arrested on minor charges, and being deported for it.
Those stories and more coming up after these headlines.
I'm Nell Abram with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Millions of people continue to be displaced by floods in Pakistan as monsoons are expected to last until the weekend. Floodwaters have moved from the northwest through the country's central Punjab and are now inundating the Sindh province in the south. The UN says the disaster eclipses the devastation of the earthquake in Haiti. And in China, the death toll from landslides over the weekend has climbed to 700. More than 1,000 people are still missing. Rescue efforts are ongoing today. Thousands of troops are working alongside local residents to unearth victims along the largely deforested mountain slopes. The landslide also blocked a river, creating a lake that now threatens to overflow. Engineers are using controlled explosions to divert the water and avoid further devastation. Preliminary results show Rwandan President Paul Kagame is set to be re-elected for another 7 years in office. With more than a third of all polling stations' results counted, Rwanda's National Election Commission found Kagame got 93% of the vote. Zach Badorf reports from Kigali, the country's capital, on the Central African nation's second presidential vote since the 1994 genocide that left 800,000 people dead.
With more than 1.5 million votes counted, results point to a landslide victory for incumbent Paul Kagame in the presidential vote. But critics say the problem was in the run-up to the polls. Amnesty International said a climate of repression in Rwanda led to limited freedom of expression ahead of the presidential election day. The African Union's team of 20 election observers found no irregularities on Monday's vote. Anil Gayan, the head of the observer group, said even before voting day, there were no problems.
We met presidential candidates and their parties, and each time we asked the question whether they have anything to complain about, they said no. So if the stakeholders themselves don't find anything wrong with the process, we on our side have not observed anything that would suggest the opposite.
More than 5 million people, half the country's population, were eligible to vote in Monday's poll. Zach Badorf, FSRN, Kigali, Rwanda.
U.S. House members took up two measures today in a special session. After a very brief debate, the House agreed to add two more unpiloted drones and some 1,500 additional troops along the U.S.-Mexico border. The tab? $600 million. They also passed a $26 billion jobs bill that would extend Medicare monies. The savings would then allow states to keep up to 160,000 teachers in the classroom. It would also protect the ranks of first responders, including more than 150,000 police officers, and protect a broad array of other public sector workers from layoffs. The measure is paid for in two ways, by plugging a tax break for businesses that send jobs overseas, and by cutting help for hungry families. The food assistance cuts aren't expected until 2014. The Senate acted on the two bills last week. Most of South Africa's 1.3 million government workers stayed away from work today, calling for a pay increase. Unions warn that more damaging protests will follow if the government does not meet their demands. Davison Makanga reports from Cape Town.
Thousands marched into the parliament in Cape Town. Thousands more did the same in the capital, Pretoria. Workers from sectors such as health, education and correctional services are demanding an 8.6% rise in salaries and 1,000 South African rands, about $140, as housing subsidy. The government is offering 7% and just over half of the housing allowance called for by workers. Lumkle Ndawone, a prison officer at Cape Town's Portsmouth Prison, earns a monthly gross salary of just over $700, and he says it's not enough.
Hey, the money that we are getting now is totally unacceptable. It's peanuts, you know. You can't even buy enough food for the children.
The Confederation of South African Trade Unions say this is just but a signal of more things to come if the government does not give in to their demands. Meanwhile, schools were most affected by the strike today as teachers stayed away. The government says minimal impact was felt in essential sectors, such as health and security services, as they brought in contract workers. Tefson Makanga, FSRN, Cape Town.
Former Alaska Senator Ted Stevens, the nation's longest-serving Republican senator, is dead. According to a family spokesperson, Stevens was among at least five people who perished after a small plane crashed in Alaska Monday. Former NASA Administrator Sean O'Keefe was one of the nine people on board. No word yet as to his condition. Several passengers survived but have injuries. Stevens' four-decade-long tenure in the Senate ended after a corruption scandal in 2008. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. Defense Secretary Robert Gates says he's cutting thousands of jobs and putting in place spending freezes at the Pentagon. The billions of dollars he hopes to save will go to more equipment buildup, but won't reduce the agency's overall budget. That brought criticism from defense analysts and lawmakers who want to bring down the department's annual budget, which is projected at around $700 billion. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington.
With the deficit soaring at record levels, every agency in Washington is bracing for spending cuts. Defense analysts say Gates is trying to keep those cuts from being imposed on the Pentagon by announcing them on his own. Gates has asked the president to unwind the U.S. Joint Forces Command, which means cutting around 6,000 jobs in Virginia, more than half of them held by government contractors. Secretary Gates also says he wants to end redundancies in the agency and cut spending on contractors by 10% over each of the next 3 years.
The ultimate success of these initiatives, as well as the other reforms underway, in the end will depend on a fundamental change in culture and attitude across our defense institutions. The culture of endless money that has taken hold must be replaced by a culture of savings and restraint.
Gates wants to save $100 billion over the next 5 years in order to pay for new equipment. Analysts say it's good news that Gates wants to reduce the military's dependence on outside contractors. But Winslow Wheeler, the director of the Center for Defense Information, says Gates may be putting the cart before the horse.
The Pentagon doesn't know how many support contractors it has. They need to understand what the denominator is before they start declaring that they're going to reduce it by 10%. We have the same problem in spending. The Pentagon does literally not know how it spends the money appropriated to it by Congress.
The estimate of military contractors ranges from more than 700,000 to about 1.2 million, but it's unclear. Critics say there's another problem with the announcement. This year, a Pentagon budget board recommended that Gates trim about 100,000 civilian jobs. His plan calls for eliminating less than a tenth of that. But even the small number Gates is trying to cut is meeting resistance in Congress. The command that is being closed is based in Norfolk, Virginia. Republican Congress member Randy Forbes of Virginia says the plan is short-sighted.
I think it's just, again, a further example of this administration allowing the budget for their social agendas to drive our defense spending instead of defense needs.
Some analysts say that's a part of the problem with this Congress. They want the deficit reduced, but not when it comes to cuts in their home states. Again, Winslow Wheeler.
The moral, mental breakdown we've got in Congress about this, clearly the leadership for doing this does not exist now, and one hopes it'll emerge, but it looks like a pretty bleak wasteland in Congress these days.
Some anti-war Democrats say the Pentagon needs to focus on cutting Cold War-era weapons, like fighter jets and missile defense systems, which could save tens of billions of dollars annually. The Pentagon's budget has doubled in the past decade, which Congressmember Lynn Woosley says is a big problem.
Of course it's bloated, and of course it has to be cut.
Gates says this round of cuts is a precursor to further budget trimming. Arizona Democratic Congressmember Ed Pastor says making the Pentagon more efficient now will help the military prioritize better in the coming years.
So by taking this money, he can reset the priorities, and then hopefully the next step will be where we can cut. So we won't be dealing with redundancy or things that really don't count towards our security or defense.
Woosley and the progressives still aren't buying the plan, though. She says there is an obvious place to cut back on military spending, and that's with a full troop drawdown in Afghanistan. Matt Laszlo, FSRN, Washington.
Civilian casualties in Afghanistan rose by a third in the first 6 months of this year, with about 1,300 killed and an estimated 2,000 injured. That's according to a report released today by the UN Assistance Mission in Afghanistan. For more on the effect of the Afghan war on civilians, 8 months into Obama's new strategy for the war, we go to Afghan-based journalist Anand Gopal. He joins us from Kabul. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you.
One of the most disturbing parts of the report is that it finds an increase in attacks on women and children by Taliban and other anti-government forces. Some figures from the study, it says 55% more children killed than in 2009, 6% more women, and improvised explosive devices or IEDs have caused a 155% increase in deaths of children. What's behind this?
Well, I think it's actually the increased use of IEDs that's behind this. I don't think it's actually a purposeful targeting of children this year versus last year. But what happens in Afghanistan, typically in the villages, it's children that are outside most of the time. The men are in the fields and the women are in the houses. And it's a very striking thing when you go into these villages, you'll see mostly children everywhere. These roadside bombs that the insurgents are planting, they go off when a vehicle drives over them, and often the people who are killed are not even the people inside the vehicle, but people who are standing around, and often this is children. I think this is the biggest reason for this increase.
Now, one of the biggest criticisms of NATO forces is the high civilian deaths from aerial strikes, especially from the unmanned drone airstrikes. Now, this report finds a 64% decrease in deaths and injuries to civilians due to NATO aerial strikes. The report connects the decrease to General McChrystal's shift in strategy in 2009, but there were still 69 civilians were still killed and 45 injured in the first 6 months of 2010 due to these airstrikes. Now, have things really improved in that area, or is this still a concern from people there?
Well, things have improved because there are less airstrikes than there were the year before. But one thing that's important to keep in mind when reading these numbers is that they're very rough numbers. It's very difficult to exactly say. There's a lot of incidents that are not reported as well. Just as an example, just 2 weeks ago, a NATO airstrike killed up to 50 people. The local community claimed 50 people were killed. ISAF has claimed 10 or 11 people were killed. If in the first 10 months 69 people were killed in airstrikes, that doesn't include these sorts of figures that I just mentioned. So it's very difficult to say the exact numbers that are killed from both sides, including the Taliban.
Well, if casualties from that recent strike were to be included here, that would almost double this number, I guess.
That's right. And even in addition to airstrikes, ground raids are even less likely to be reported.
Well, let's talk about those ground raids, especially the night raids. That's something that this report does talk about. It says that NATO forces really need to increase transparency in that area. You've reported on the effect of night raids by special forces on the civilian population there. Has there been a decrease in these kind of operations?
There doesn't appear to be a decrease at all in the last few months. I think they're continuing at the same level. And again, the difficulty in saying anything too specific or definite about these raids is that they are so secretive. There is no transparency in the process. So in many cases, there'll be raids, people will be captured or even killed, and we don't learn about them until months later, if at all.
The report also looks at incidents of civilian casualties by region, and it shows that the civilian casualties grew the most in the southern Afghanistan during this period. Now, that's exactly where NATO troops increased their presence with the Marja offensive earlier this year. Does that mean even with 15,000 more troops, it actually became more dangerous for civilians there?
Well, absolutely. The southern Afghanistan today is much more dangerous than it was a year ago. The levels of violence in the south today are unprecedented, that if you compare it to any other time in the last 10 years, this is the most violent year in the south.
So the bottom line seems to be from this report and this data is that the number of killings attributed to NATO forces has decreased, but for civilians, the overall rate of casualties is still increasing. I mean, basically, this report says that anti-government forces such as the Taliban are killing 50% more civilians than in 2009. I mean, what does that mean for daily life there in Afghanistan?
Daily life is getting more and more difficult. Like I said, this year was the record for violence, and that broke last year's record, which broke the record of the year before. So it's a really, really difficult situation. You're seeing larger communities of squatters that are growing around some of the cities. These are people who have fled the war zones and are set up makeshift camps. They're internally displaced people. You're seeing more and more people leave the country even because of this sort of effect. So it's a really difficult situation for civilians across the board.
Anand Gopal is an Afghan-based journalist. He joined us from Kabul to talk about the increase in Afghan civilian casualties during the first 6 months of this year. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Google and Verizon have announced their plan for net neutrality. In a joint statement, the corporations say they're against charging different rates for service online. But progressive groups and open internet supporters are calling it the end of a democratic internet as we know it. Tanya Snyder reports.
Advocates of a free and open internet feared the worst as they awaited the details of the Google-Verizon deal. And they say it's worse than they feared.
They'll be acting as gatekeepers, making the choices for us, the users, at the end of the line.
Susan Crawford is a law professor specializing in information technology.
The deal presents the possibility that the carriers are going to choose which speech gets there more successfully, which business models are actually able to reap returns, and which of us gets to have the internet experience we want.
Google and Verizon's announcement was not so much a business deal between the two companies as it was a proposal for how net neutrality should go forward. They couched it in language defending an open internet free from discrimination of content. But it does draw a line between wireless and wireline communications.
The concept around wireless is that it's a nascent industry with lots of competition that's evolving very rapidly.
Peter Thonis is a spokesperson for Verizon.
If you look at the internet itself, it was not regulated early on, and it was allowed to flourish and develop, which is really where we are with the wireless technologies.
But he says that doesn't mean they're instituting some kind of pay-to-play system. He says the critics have it wrong.
The internet as we know it today wouldn't change and would probably just get stronger. You know, what I think they're fixated on is a very small part of this agreement, and that has to do with managed networks, which really have, you know, nothing to do with the internet.
But progressives say the proposed system would divide the information superhighway with fast lanes reserved for the big players and everyone else in the slow lane. That's especially dangerous for marginalized communities who have historically had a hard time getting their voices heard. That's according to James Rucker, who directs colorofchange.org, a group that uses the internet to strengthen the political voice of Black America.
For the first time in a very long time, maybe in history, there's been this platform where communities of color, marginalized voices, can speak authentically without corporate gatekeepers. And essentially what Google is now doing is making this kind of big first foray into undoing that.
Especially disturbing to progressives is the way in which Google and Verizon have had private conversations about how the internet will be managed, and that they now seem to be telling the Federal Communications Commission how they want to be regulated. Again, Susan Crawford.
Under the Bush administration, we deregulated all of these actors and decided that they wouldn't be subject to any rules at all. The FCC thought that competition would constrain any abuses that these carriers wanted to carry out. That has not happened. We don't have adequate competition for high-speed internet access, and these carriers have an awful lot of market power.
So recently, when Comcast was blocking the file-sharing site BitTorrent, the FCC told them to stop. But a court ruled against the FCC, saying they can't regulate what's been deregulated. Advocates say all the FCC has to do is change the way they classify broadband communications, and they can regulate it again. But that hasn't happened. Tanya Snyder, FSRN, Washington.
Internal government documents released today show that the Obama administration is deporting thousands of immigrants who have no criminal record. That's according to advocacy groups who sued the government to get information on the Secure Communities program launched in 2008. The program processes fingerprint records through databases when people are arrested, even when charges are minor or the charges are dismissed. The information is gathered before conviction when the individual is presumed innocent, which immigrant rights groups say raises issues over the true intent of the program. To date, nearly 80% of those deported under Secure Communities were not criminals or were picked up for lower-level offenses. Bridget Kessler is one of the attorneys who litigated the FOIA lawsuit against Immigration and Customs Enforcement. She outlined some of the findings of the data.
Some of the most telling numbers come from places like Travis County, Texas, where 82% of Secure Communities deportations are of non-criminals. In Miami-Dade, Florida, 66% of Secure Communities deportations are of non-criminals. And finally, in Maricopa, Arizona, where we all know Sheriff Joe Arpaio works, is 54% of Secure Communities deportations are of non-criminals.
The program, like Arizona's SB 1070 law, is another way of involving local law enforcement in federal immigration law. It operates in nearly 500 jurisdictions in 27 states. Sheriff Michael Hennessy of San Francisco said his efforts to opt out of the program were blocked, both by ICE officials and California's state attorney. Hennessy, who has 30 years of experience as a sheriff, said the program could have negative impact on local policing.
There's a great concern that linking local law enforcement with ICE has a detrimental effect on law enforcement, that witnesses will not come forward and testify because they're afraid they'll be turned over to ICE. Victims, particularly victims of domestic violence, will not report the crime because they're afraid that they'll be referred to ICE and deported. And it really has a chilling effect on the cooperation level between local law enforcement and minority communities, and in San Francisco, particularly the Hispanic community.
Also today, Department of Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano said the Secure Communities program will expand to all 25 counties along the southwest border. The department calls it part of a, quote, smart, effective border security program. The DHS said it plans to expand the program to every law enforcement jurisdiction in the country by 2013. As wildfires rage across Russia and the death toll rises, many critics say the government's response to the disaster has been inadequate. Officials have been quick to proclaim control of the fires, but mobilizations to save villages have been slow. The ongoing disaster may further fuel popular opposition to the current regime at a time when the government has made moves to crack down on the strengthening grassroots movement that is fighting for official accountability, the rule of law, and an end to corruption. Jenny Johnson reports.
Critics say the government's response to the wildfires demonstrates that officials are more concerned with keeping up an appearance of control than protecting people from harm. Oksana Chelysheva is on the board of the Russian-Chechen Friendship Society and has been living in Helsinki for the past 2 years as a writer in exile due to her human rights advocacy in Russia. Chelysheva's native town of Nizhny Novgorod is facing some of the worst damage from the fires. She says the government's response exemplifies the lack of respect for human life on the part of those in power.
A horrific number of villages are destroyed to ashes. Many people died in the fires. And at the same time, the authorities of Nizhny Novgorod have done nothing to alleviate the plight of the people.
Chelly Shiva says people have been left to fight the fires on their own, and a recent visit by Putin to the city revealed the anger people feel toward the authorities.
Vladimir Putin really retreated from the crowd of women of this town who nearly tore him to pieces.
Angry reaction to the disaster comes amid a growing movement opposing widespread corruption and the lack of rule of law in Russia. It also comes as Russian President Dmitry Medvedev recently signed into law new powers of surveillance for the Federal Security Service, or FSB. The law allows agents to fine or arrest any citizen suspected of creating the conditions for a crime to be committed in the future. Human rights activists say the new powers, combined with existing retrogressive laws, could have a chilling effect on the opposition movement. Legal permits for demonstrations are already routinely denied by authorities, and Chelly Shiva says the new law could criminalize planning a demonstration.
I feel that the law will be applied against those who are in opposition movement, because now the FSB has got a possibility under, so to say, legal grounds to prevent people from joining protest actions.
The new law is a direct reaction to the increased activities of grassroots organizations, says Kerko Paninen of the Finnish-Russian Civic Forum, a group that promotes liberal reforms in Russia.
More and more ordinary people, previously totally apolitical people, have gotten involved in the protest movement, in the popular protest movement. So we may see this new FSB law as a reaction to the increased mobilization or the increased protest activity of ordinary people in Russia.
But while the protest movement is growing, inside government, watchdogs are being pushed out. On the same day the FSB laws went into effect, the head of the President's Council on Human Rights, Ella Pamfilova, resigned. Pamfilova, a longtime political insider, was facing a hostile climate in her office after she criticized a nationalist pro-Kremlin youth group called Nashi, or Ours, for a fascist display at their annual summer camp in July. The display featured pictures of the impaled heads of a prominent human rights activist and several opposition figures under the message, "You are not welcome here." The Kremlin failed to come to her defense, says Tonya Lokshina of Human Rights Watch in Moscow.
I think that had President Medvedev actually tried to convince Ms. Pamfilova to stay on, had he promised her his support, she would have stayed. But without his backing, she really had no other way out. And that's incredibly unfortunate. And that tells you a lot about the current human rights situation in Russia.
The human rights problem in Russia is linked to larger issues of corruption and the lack of legal recourse in the courts, according to the Civic Forum's Paninen. He says people feel that the state is not there to protect them and cannot turn to it for help.
There is no authority in Russia that would protect law. There is no authority in Russia that would protect the sanctity of agreements, which is crucial for business, for instance. So what this leads to within society is animosity between peoples, because there is no protective force to regulate the relationship between peoples. What we see in Russia more and more is that people are becoming islands. They are acting as if I am alone in this world and all my responsibility is toward me and my closest ones.
Activists are pressing the European Union to use its economic relationship with Russia to demand greater respect for democracy and human rights. Jenny Johnson, FSRN, Helsinki.
And that wraps up today's program. This is Free Speech Radio News. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina.